This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Bill Moyers is returning to weekly television this week after having retired from it in 2004 when he was 70. His new Friday night PBS series, Bill Moyers Journal, premieres with a special edition this Wednesday. It's a documentary called Buying the War, which explores the role of the press in the lead-up to the war in Iraq and asks why the press didn't do a more effective job in challenging the Bush administration on false or exaggerated claims. I spoke with Moyers about his return to PBS and about how his previous PBS show was secretly monitored by the then head of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting to see if the show had a left-wing bias. Let's start with Moyers' documentary, Buying the War. Here's a clip in which Walter Isaacson, who headed CNN during the lead-up to the war in Iraq, talks about how many journalists at that time felt constrained from reporting critically on the Bush administration.
There was a patriotic fervor, and the administration used it so that if you challenged anything, you were made to feel that there was something wrong with that. And there was even almost a patriotism police, which, you know, they'd be up there on the internet sort of picking anything a Christiane Amanpour or somebody else would say as if it were disloyal.
We interviewed a former reporter at CNN who had been there through that period, and this reporter said to us, quote, everybody on staff just sort of knew not to push too hard to do stories critical of the Bush administration.
Especially at right after 9/11, especially when the war in Afghanistan is going on, there was a real sense that you don't get that critical of a government that's leading us in wartime.
That's a clip from the new Bill Moyers documentary, Buying the War. Bill Moyers, welcome back to Fresh Air. What are some of the other things you learned in this documentary about how CNN tried to prevent coverage from being too critical of the Bush administration in the lead up to the war?
Well, during the Afghan bombings, which were our retaliation, the U.S. government's retaliation to the 9/11 attacks from the base of Osama bin Laden, CNN reported, showed some of the, you know, what we call collateral damage, the human cost, the human deaths and the human calamities that resulted from our force. And when they ran on CNN, Walter Isaacson and the producers and reporters there heard from what Isaacson called the Patriot Police, the corporate executives, as he says in my broadcast, some advertisers, and in particular, the watchdogs on the right, who believed that showing anything negative about our response to the Taliban and to Osama bin Laden was un-American. And he felt that pressure every day, he told me in my interview with him.
And he warned his staff, he says, not to focus too much on casualties in Afghanistan and to balance reports on those casualties with reminders of the damages done to America on September 11th.
Yes, he wrote a memorandum, which was finally leaked to the New York Times, and he told his producers, his reporters, his staff that if they did continue to show the human casualties of American force, they needed also to remind people that there had been the casualties caused by the terrorists at 9/11. And it was his way to try to keep putting into context, because of the pressure he was feeling and getting, to put into context the cause of the bombing that produced the deaths and the destruction from American firepower.
Now, as you point out in your documentary, at the same time that CNN is trying to be very careful about not being too critical about what's happening in Afghanistan and always reminding people that this is a response to September 11th, Fox News is trying to position CNN as being the liberal news network.
And by liberal, they meant, you know, the anti-American, anti-war network.
How effective do you think Fox News was in giving CNN that reputation as being liberal and biased?
I think Fox was very effective. They exploited the emotional sentiments and the passions and the fears that had risen in response to the terrorist attacks on 9/11. And it when Pearl Harbor was attacked, many Americans rallied, of course, naturally and patriotically to the administration, the Roosevelt administration. This happened in 9/11. People were uncertain about the sources of this terrorism. They were scared that there would be more of them, and there was a feeling, you know, punch the guys back in the nose, go after them. And I decided to do this. I knew one night late when I was watching the Letterman show, the David Letterman show, and Dan Rather was on, very emotional about the impact of 9/11 on him. He'd been down, looked at the casualties in the World Trade Center. He'd looked up and had seen human beings throwing themselves out of 40, 50-story buildings with flames licking at their heels and hurling themselves to death. He was very moved that night on the Letterman show, and that's when he said, you know, wherever the president wants me to do, whatever the president wants me to do, I will do it. Dan says in the broadcast, in my documentary, that, you know, he regrets that now, although it was a legitimate feeling. All of us were feeling that. My office is only a mile and a quarter from the World Trade Center. My wife and I were there working. We were feeling this these sentiments of, you know, wanting to find out who did it and get back at them. I think that's a natural response. Fox came in, put the flags in their lapels, put the martial music on the screen, and started exploiting that fear and that passion and turning it into a sort of a pro-America, pro-war sentiment. And it put everybody else on the defensive. If you begin to be skeptical of the administration's claims once the White House started saying that Saddam Hussein was behind this, they'd come after you and say, you know, you're undermining the president, you're undermining the credibility of your commander-in-chief. What's wrong with you? And that had a very powerful effect on people, on journalists.
Did it have an effect on you ever in the back of your mind when you were having critics on of the Bush administration and during the lead-up to the war in Iraq? Was there ever a voice in the back of your mind saying, this might be divisive for our country to hear this? This might undermine the Bush administration when we need our country to be strong.
No, Terry, I didn't. You have to remember that I was there in the 60s, in the early days of Lyndon Johnson's escalation of the war in Vietnam. And we made so many of the mistakes that the Bush administration began to repeat after 9/11 that I had a strong sense of deja vu. And the fact that I had come out of an administration that had misread intelligence, that had leaped to premature judgments, that had gone to war on a suspicion, made me much more skeptical, I think, than anybody else. I mean, like a veteran of a war is more skeptical of going back into of what war really is than somebody who hasn't been. So I felt our obligation, that our mission as journalists at that time, was to challenge authority. It was not to take the president at his word. It was to ask the questions that a country needs to know before it sends its men and women into combat. So, no, I never thought that. And, I mean, I had people on who were for the war. It was interesting. The neoconservatives would not come on my broadcast. They wanted to go into friendly, hospitable environments. But I had a number of members of Congress who supported the war. I had others who, journalists who were pro the administration, but I also had a lot of early critics. In fact, it was on my show now with Bill Moyers that Joe Wilson made one of his early appearances, and we now have a record from within the White House that people watch that at the White House and begin to say, this guy Wilson is somebody we have to get after. So, no, I really felt that our obligation as journalists was to ask these questions and give the critics of the war a hearing.
During the lead-up to the war in Iraq, Phil Donahue had a short-lived show on MSNBC. And he says that his show was perceived as too liberal, and he was given certain guidelines to follow to balance the show in the way that the editorial staff wanted it balanced. What were the guidelines he was given?
He says that he was told that he had to have two conservatives for every liberal, and they counted him as two because he was pretty outspoken. But when he would try to have Scott Ritter on, Scott Ritter was the weapons inspector who was reporting from Iraq that there was no truth to these allegations about Saddam Hussein's weapons of mass destruction. So when he always had to balance someone who was skeptical of the war with at least one and usually two supporters of the war. He says in the documentary, in my interview with him, that came directly from management. When the Donahue show was canceled, MSNBC and NBC, its parent, said, well, it was because he wasn't doing that well in the ratings. Donahue insists that he was holding his own in the ratings, not setting the world on fire, but he was holding his own. And he is convinced, as in fact we learned from another memo, internal memo of MSNBC that was also leaked, we learned that an internal memo at NBC said, look, we don't need the face of a liberal critic like Donahue at this time of a need for patriotism.
Now, a lot of your documentary, Buying the War, focuses on the Washington Press Corps and how you think they bought the war, and Buying the War is the title of the documentary. And you know, an example that you give is, and this is a kind of process example, you talk about the day that Judith Miller and Michael Gordon had a front page story in the New York Times saying that Saddam Hussein was on this worldwide search for materials to build a nuclear weapon and that they'd gotten their hands on aluminum tubes which could be used to build a nuclear weapon. And that same morning, as the New York Times story appeared on the front page, what happened?
Vice President Cheney went on Meet the Press, and when pressed by Tim Russert about the story on the front page of the New York Times, Cheney, who had refused to talk about issues of national security, intelligence like that, said, well, you know, we have it confirmed by the story in the New York Times this morning. Now, that story was a leak from the administration, so you had, in essence, the leaker being asked by a mainstream journalist to confirm his own leak. Wasn't identified as Cheney's leak, although I have no doubt but that it came from Cheney's office, and we learned a lot in the Libby trial about that sort of thing. So it was a sort of, you know, it's a cliche to say it now, but it was a perfect storm or a perfect triangle. The government leaks an intelligence report. It's a wrong intelligence report. It's a false intelligence report, but they leak it. The New York Times prints it, and the talk shows on Sunday confirm it. By actually having the leakers on to say, well, the New York Times says it must be so. Some people in my broadcast say this was the consummate moment when it was clear to them that that there was collusion or at least an embrace of the administration and the mainstream media, particularly the Sunday, the broadcast networks on going to war.
And another version of how this might have happened is given on your show, and that version is that a third party, maybe Ahmet Chalabi, tells Judith Miller and Michael Gordon about these aluminum tubes, also tells the Bush administration. So when Judith Miller or Michael Gordon goes to the Bush administration to confirm the stuff about the aluminum tubes, they have that information, they'll confirm it, but it's from the same source, and that source is still never... The information is still never really corroborated.
That's right. On my Friday night broadcast, I do an interview with Carlos Bonini. Carlos Bonini is the Cy Hirsch of Italy. He's Rome's leading investigative reporter. He's got a new book out called Collusion, in which he talks about the story of the yellow cake, the story that Saddam Hussein had sent his agents to Niger to buy the so-called yellow cake that's needed for uranium enrichment. And Bonini's book reports with documentation how that story was fabricated by a shadowy figure in the Italian underworld with contacts to the Italian intelligence agency, their CIA, which is called SISMI. Those forged documents and those documents that the President of the United States quoted, in effect, in his State of the Union message, that intelligence from that forged document was taken by Italian intelligence through Silvio Berlusconi, the Prime Minister of Italy, to the White House. Berlusconi wanted to ingratiate himself to President Bush, so he was brought this information about Italian intelligence discovering this document that confirmed the report in Niger. Bush was impressed with it. The U.S. intelligence called the Brits in London to see if they had the information. They had the information because Italian intelligence had taken it to them too. So they took it as confirmed. They were both confirming their use of material that had been forged and given to both of them by Italian intelligence. It's the same sort of circular process that was going on between much of the mainstream media in this country at the same time.
My guest is Bill Moyers. His new Friday night PBS series premieres this week with a special Wednesday night edition, a documentary called Buying the War. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Bill Moyers, and beginning at the end of April, he's going to be back on PBS with a weekly program that will be called Bill Moyers Journal. It begins on Friday, April 27th, but a couple of days before that, on Wednesday, April 25th, he has a documentary premiering called Buying the War. And the premise of the documentary is that the Washington Press Corps bought what the Bush administration was selling in the lead-up to the war, even though a lot of the information wasn't accurate. Why do you think that the Washington Press Corps bought the information?
First, let me say there were exceptions, and our documentary reports on what the then Knight Ridder Bureau, led by John Walcott, a crusty veteran of many years of covering Washington, and two of his star reporters, Strobel and Lande. I mean, they were ahead of everybody on this story. They were skeptical from the beginning because they had sources deep inside the military at the level of the colonels and the majors, and they had old sources of theirs inside the intelligence agencies and the State Department. And they were on this story from the very beginning, the story that the intelligence was being cooked, that there were real questions about whether or not Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction, and that Saddam Hussein did not have any ties to 9/11 through al-Qaeda. They were onto the story, but because they don't have an outlet in Washington or an outlet in New York, where the news capitals of America, they were ignored by the mainstream press. But back to your question as to why it happened. Well, first of all, there was the emotional response to 9/11, in which many journalists like Dan Rather on the David Letterman show were deeply affected by the sneak attacks that cost so many thousands of American lives. And their judgment, their skepticism was suspended in that time of trauma. It's also the sin of being inside, the sin of in, I call it. I mean, we learned in the Vietnam War that early in the Vietnam War, that if the president said there was a threat, then the reporters and the editors tended to believe there was a threat, but they didn't ask for the actual evidence. It was the reporting of David Halberstam and Morley Safer and Peter Arnett out in Vietnam that very quickly in Vietnam undermined the authority, the official view of reality by reporting facts on the ground. We didn't have that kind of reporting in the build-up to the Iraqi war. There were few American reporters there. They couldn't get to the stories that would counter the official view of reality that was being passed out gratis in Washington. Then you also have, Terry, this powerful ideological partisan press, talk radio, Rush Limbaugh, Fox News, the bloggers by this time, whose mission is to advance the political aims of the Republican Party. This press is part of a political movement, so that anyone who reports what is contrary to their view of the world, who reports information, news that seems to contradict their principal political leaders, the president and the administration, they come down hard on. So you had the willingness of the mainstream press to go along with the administration because they see themselves as the extension of authority and power, and they're in the game. And you have this relentless beating up of any dissident mainstream journalists who deviate from the official view of reality by a political press whose main interest is in advancing the administration's arguments and case.
Because your new documentary examines the coverage, TV and newspapers in the lead-up to the war, I'm wondering if you think that there's a kind of false way of measuring fairness that might sound like fairness, but you think maybe isn't really as accurate as it seems, or, you know, in terms of actually measuring fairness?
Splitting the difference between two opinions does not get you to the truth. It gets you to another opinion. I believe that we journalists are obligated to get people as close as possible to the verifiable truth, no matter
you're
what.
You're talking about having, like, the guy from the left and the guy from the right and
yeah.
saying, well, the truth is somewhere in between.
The Republican Center, the Democratic Center, and saying, okay, you decide what the truth is. I believe we journalists are obligated to get people close to the verifiable truth, and that the conclusions I reach, the analysis I make, are substantiated by the evidence I've collected. That's what I mean by credibility, and it's what I mean by judgment. We make a judgment based upon the information. Our judgment has to be compared to the credibility of the information. Let me just say say one thing about buying the war. People say to me, people have asked me, why is it important today? It happened 4 years ago. Well, this war is still going on, Terry, 4 years after the collusion between the mainstream media and the administration. If your fire department in your neighborhood is in collusion with the arsonist, you want to know about it to avoid the fire next time. If the dog doesn't bark, you want to know if the dog is licking the boots of the burglar.
Is collusion too strong a word?
Oh, I think collusion was a very appropriate word for some of members. Remember, there are a lot of people, there are a lot of members of the press. Everybody didn't collude, but some did. I mean, the Weekly Standard, Rupert Murdoch's weekly newspaper in Washington, was taking leaks from the Pentagon and printing them and putting them into the argument. No, there was collusion between some members of the press, no question about it, and with the defectors, with Amakcheli, Shalabi, and people like that. There was collusion. In some, there was being used as an innocent or idiot fool.
Bill Moyers' new Friday night PBS series, Bill Moyers' Journal, premieres this week with a special Wednesday night edition, a documentary called Buying the War. Moyers will be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Bill Moyers. He has a new weekly series called Bill Moyers' Journal that premieres this week on PBS. He's won more than 30 Emmys as well as 9 Peabodys. Early in his career, he served as special assistant and press secretary to President Lyndon Johnson. Moyers last joined us in 2004 when he was preparing to retire from his weekly PBS TV series, which was called Now. You were basically accused by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting of having a liberal bias. And we learned that Kenneth Tomlinson, who was appointed to serve as chair of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting by President Bush in 2003, had commissioned a study spending $10,000 to investigate whether there was a liberal bias on your program. What have you learned about how that investigation was conducted and what the criteria were for measuring if there was a bias on your show?
Well, what the Inspector General of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and members of Congress learned is that Kenneth Tomlinson did not act in a straightforward and he didn't play by the rules. He misused Corporation for Public Broadcasting money. He singled out Now with Bill Moyers for a bias that didn't exist. We know that he was trying to discredit the kind of journalism that we were practicing. He tried to accuse us of promoting a liberal agenda. You know, for years, the right-wing movement has branded anyone who was critical of them or who didn't report the world as they see it as liberal. You know, there's no question. I came out of two liberal administrations, the Kennedy-Johnson administration 40 years ago. There's no hiding the fact that I believe that collectively we can do things that we can't do individually. I don't think markets solve all of our problems. If that makes me a liberal, I'm a liberal. But in my journalism, I believe in trying to get people as close as possible to the verifiable truth. And our reporting was about the very issues, the war in Iraq, the growing inequality in this country, the decline of the middle class, outsourcing, offshore tax havens, all of that, that was at odds with the view of the world being promoted by the ideologues in Washington. And unfortunately, Mr. Tomlinson, whom I had wanted to meet, I wrote Ken Tomlinson 3 times and asked him if I could come and meet with the board of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and find out why they were so restless, because I was present at the signing of the Public Broadcasting Act of 1967. We believe that the Corporation for Public Broadcasting should be a heat shield to protect the producers and journalists of the National Public Radio and public television from the very kind of political motives that were driving Ken Tomlinson and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. And, you know, all of this came out in the investigation by the Inspector General of the CPB and by some inquiries from Congress, and Kenneth had to resign from his office. That's the past. I don't know what Ken is doing now. I'm back practicing journalism, and I'm practicing the kind of journalism that either will stand or fall on the documentation and the evidence that we offer for the reporting we do. And that's what I think all of us should be about.
Did you actually get to read the study that Tomlinson commissioned of your show?
No, I mean, I could have, but I didn't want to. You know, he'd hired some old friend of his to do this report that this guy was supposed to watch the broadcast and report to Tomlinson what was on it, who was being interviewed. As I said in a speech I gave after I retired in 2004, voluntarily from the show, all Kenton had to do was call me and I'd tell him what was on, or all he had to do was watch the broadcast and he'd find out what was on, or he could even read the TV guide. And I'd offer to give him a subscription to it. You know, to this day, I've yet to have a conversation, despite my calls and my letters to him, with Ken Tomlinson. And I'm going to write him. I hear he's working on a book. I'll be interviewing some book authors on my weekly show. I'll see if he comes on and wants to talk about this. I believe the job of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting is support the independence of producers and journalists in public radio and public television, and whether the Democrats are trying to, you know, we recently had an example of Democrats in Congress, part of the Hispanic caucus, calling the president of PBS up to the Hill to chastise her over the failure of a upcoming series on World War II to include Hispanics. Well, whatever the merits of that case, the very fact that members of Congress feel they can call the president of PBS up to put her on the spot, I mean, that's exactly what we don't want in public broadcasting, and exactly why the Corporation for Public Broadcasting was established.
By the way, if you were to land an interview with Ken Tomlinson, who investigated you while he was the head of CPB, do you think you'd be able to conduct the interview without a hostile tone?
I feel no hostility to him. I'm curious. I'm not a very good devil's advocate either. I like to draw people out, not to argue with them on the air. I don't feel any hostility with Ken Tomlinson. I feel sadness that he didn't understand the mission of his office. But no, I would like to ask him what was his motive, and why does he think that reporting him? He said he was watching one of my reports from a Tamaqua, Pennsylvania, on Now with Bill Moyers. We had gone down there to look at what was happening to workers who had been the victims of outsourcing and of downsizing. And it was so moving, and their story was so powerful that we gave it an hour. We gave the whole hour to the broadcast. It was really about what's happening to working people in the middle class in this country. Ken Tomlinson told the Washington Post that he was watching that broadcast, and he said, I realized that Moyers had a, quote, liberal agenda, and I was incensed by it. I would like to ask Ken Tomlinson, if whether you're liberal or conservative, what's happening to the middle class, what's happening to working people in this country, what's happening to the standard of living for people who live paycheck to paycheck, isn't of concern to all of us as Americans, not as conservatives or as liberals. And there, I'd like to see what his definition of some of the language of words he used might actually be.
I had the pleasure of interviewing your son when his memoir was published, I guess it was about a year ago, about his long addiction to crack and then his recovery and now his work as a vice president at Hazelden, which is a very highly esteemed rehabilitation center. And he reprints in that book some of the letters that you wrote him over the years. And some of those letters are just so eloquent. And it made me think about how few people write long letters like that. Like, everybody emails, but emails tend to be short and functional or funny, but not this kind of like long, reflective, from the heart, really eloquent kind of writing. And it made me really, because the letter as a form for that has kind of died, it made me wonder why you chose the letter as a form to sometimes communicate really profound thoughts to your son.
I started writing letters very early in April of 1954 as a sophomore at North Texas State College. I sat down one Saturday afternoon and wrote a letter to a man I'd never met named Lyndon B. Johnson, who was a United States Senator from Texas and had just been elected Majority Leader of the United States Senate. That letter, in which I carefully tried to communicate to him why I wanted to be a political journalist and what I thought he could teach me and I could teach him, got to his desk. That's how I wound up working for Lyndon Johnson that summer and sitting outside his desk. And he was a bear about answering every letter within 24 hours. And he said to me, what got my attention was your letter, and I want you to write those kind of letters to people for me. And he would edit and sign them. But he taught me that there's nothing more powerful than the case you make when you are communicating with someone with a pen and a piece of paper. Now, a typewriter and a piece of paper, a computer and a piece of paper. I never forgot the power of the written word to reach somebody else. And I've done that through the years in letters. I don't really know why I'm in broadcasting, frankly, because I would prefer to write letters. I wound up in a medium where there isn't the time and the opportunity to be that deliberate. And I guess that's one reason I make so many mistakes in live interviews. But I do learn. I do think the art, the power of communicating privately is in the care you take to put on a piece of paper what you're really thinking, because you know somebody else is going to ponder and receive and absorb it, and you want that person to know what you're really trying to say. So a letter remains the most personal means of communication, other than looking someone in the eye and expressing your deepest thoughts of the moment. And that's harder for me to do than it is to put it into a letter. I didn't know my son was keeping those letters. I'd forgotten about those letters, and I was surprised when he was writing his book Broken about his struggle with addiction and his recovery from it, that he had kept them.
Are there people you still write those kinds of long letters to?
Yes, I do. I do. You, for one thing, I write a lot of grant proposals. You know, I have to raise every penny of every. I have to raise every penny of every production that I mount for public broadcasting, and a grant letter is a means of saying, look, here's what I want to do. Here's why it's important. Here's why I need your support. So I still do that. I tell young people that if they really want to reach me, if they really want for me to consider them for a job, write me a letter. Don't call me on the phone. I don't have time, and you don't have time to express yourself on the phone. Write me a letter. I still believe in this verbal and oral age. A letter is the most intimate conversation.
Well, Bill Moyers, thank you for talking with us. It will be great to have you back every week on PBS. Thank you.
Thank you, Terry.
Bill Moyers' new Friday night PBS series, Bill Moyers' Journal, begins this week with a special edition Wednesday, a documentary called Buying the War. This is Fresh Air.